The right to be forgotten, or is it remembered? Aging 2.0. Brookings looks at foreign direct investment in the U.S. For the first time, streaming factors into what makes a hit record gold. And it's the first of a three-part series on the role of privacy in a changing world. That's not all, but it's a start. Welcome back to 40 A&M and 5, a weekly download of 40 A&M LLC. It's Monday, July 14th, Bastille Day in France, and I'm Chris Bohm. First up for you this week, in a move that came about a week ago, Google began reinstating some of the links that it had earlier removed under the European Court of Justice's controversial Right to be Forgotten ruling. Peter Barron, head of communications for Google in Europe, told the BBC that the company is learning as we go, referring to the ruling's requirement of Google and others that they be prepared to remove links to web pages if they are deemed to be outdated, irrelevant, or no longer relevant. The requirements of the ruling have been called into question by some high-profile link removals, including when BBC economics editor Robert Preston was notified that a blog post he had written in 2007 would be removed from appearing when a specific search was carried out on Google. Google had confirmed that the subject of the article, former Merrill Lynch chief Stan O'Neill, hadn't made the request, but according to the BBC, the request appeared to relate to reader comments that had appeared underneath the story. Other reports were that as many as six Guardian articles may have been impacted as well, with Bloomberg reporting that The Telegraph also noted that links to 2010 articles about a Scottish football referee had been pulled but reinstated. To date, Google has received as many as 70,000 requests asking for the withdrawal of about 250,000 web links. On July 5th, The Washington Post's Barton Gellman, Julie Tate, and Ashkan Soltani wrote a story detailing more revelations from the cache of materials disclosed by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. In preparing their story, The Washington Post reviewed roughly 160,000 intercepted email and instant message conversations, some of them hundreds of pages long, and 7,900 documents taken from more than 11,000 accounts. As described by reporters Gellman et al., the files provided a view into the many changes wrought by Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act amendments, much of it enabling methods of intelligence gathering that had once required a probable cause and a warrant. From PRISM, which extracts content stored in user accounts at Yahoo, Microsoft, Facebook, and Google, and five other leading internet companies, to Upstream, which intercepts data as it moves across U.S. junctions of global voice and data networks. FISA content, we have been told, has been generally stored in closely controlled data repositories, and for more than a year, senior government officials, according to the Post, have been saying that it had been beyond Snowden's reach. As recently as May of this year, according to the Post, General Keith Alexander, shortly after he retired, denied that Edward Snowden could have passed FISA-authorized content to journalists. For his part, Mr. Snowden described that his unusually broad, unescorted access to raw SIGINT, short for Signals Intelligence, came under a special dual authorities role, a reference to Section 702 for domestic collection and Executive Order 12333 for overseas collection. This authority, according to Snowden and as reported by the Post, permitted him to search content stored and task new collection, for instance, entering a new selector into XKeyscore to pull a copy of an email. But what proved more startling in the Post's analysis was the degree to which ordinary internet users, Americans and non-Americans alike, far outnumbered the legally targeted foreigners in the intercepted communications. 9 of 10 account holders found in the large cache of intercepted communications were not the intended targets. Nearly half of the files, according to the Post, contained names, emails, addresses, or other details that the NSA marked as belonging to U.S. citizens or residents. Months of tracking across more than 50 alias accounts, according to the Washington Post, led directly to the 2011 capture in Pakistan of a bomb builder, and also to a suspect in the 2002 terrorist bombing in Bali. At the request of CIA officials, the Post reported withholding other examples. But many other files tell stories of love and heartbreak, illicit sexual liaisons, mental health crises, political and religious conversions, financial anxieties, and disappointed hopes. According to the Washington Post, incidental collection of third-party communications is inevitable in many forms of surveillance, but in other contexts, the U.S. government works harder to limit and discard irrelevant data. In criminal wiretaps, for example, the FBI is supposed to stop listening to a call if a suspect's wife or child is using the phone. Nonetheless, the daily lives of more than 10,000 account holders who were not targeted were caught up in the intercepted communications, cataloged, and recorded nonetheless. According to a story by the BBC last week, Russia's lower house of parliament has passed a law to require internet companies to store Russian citizen personal data inside the country, a move often called the forced localization of internet services. Vadim Dingin, the member of parliament who introduced the bill, was quoted by the BBC as saying most Russians don't want their data to leave Russia for the U.S., where it can be hacked and given to criminals, adding that companies should build data centers in Russia. Analysts are skeptical, noting fears that Russia may be seeking to create a closed and censored version of the internet within its borders. The bill must be approved still by Russia's upper chamber and President Putin, and if passed, would not take effect until September 2016. Until July 7th, a song needed to sell 600,000 copies to be awarded a platinum disc, which, like the gold designation for song sales, is sought after by any artist. Under a new system announced by the music industry's BPI, which administers the awards, every time a song is played on a site like Spotify or Deezer, it will count toward that total even if the listener hasn't purchased a copy. According to the BBC, audio streaming data for songs has now been backdated to the start of 2014, and music streams have already been accounted in compilation of the top 40. Immediate impacts were felt, as reported by the BBC. Taylor Swift's We Are Never Getting Back Together and Fix You by Coldplay were both upgraded from gold to platinum status. And artist Ariana Grande became the first to top the combined chart with her hit Problem, which racked up an impressive 702,000 streams. National Public Radio's Ina Jaffe reported last week on a company that is focused on making sure that technologies aimed at older adults have the benefit of advice and analysis straight from their target market. The company, Aging 2.0, was co-founded by Katie Fike, and according to NPR, it's part of a fast-growing industry worth $2 billion at present. As she told NPR, one of the things that Aging 2.0 is most passionate about is making sure that entrepreneurs, many of whom are in their 20s and 30s, are really getting important feedback on what their end users want and need. In a way, their mission has become, for aging baby boomers, to help Silicon Valley asking the age-old Madison Avenue question, does it play in Peoria? In other words, is it relevant, will it work, and will I use it? All critical to new technologies that hope to stay on the shelf and not gather dust in the bin of innovation. Aging 2.0 does not develop products for other adults, but according to NPR, works with startups that do. And in exchange for helping them find support and financing, Aging 2.0 gets a small stake in the companies it helps. Ms. Fike sees the market for services targeted to the aging population is growing. As with family size shrinking, there are fewer kids to take care of a rapidly growing number of elderly people. One service cited by Ms. Fike to NPR is called Lively, which collects sensor-fed data to a web page that both Fike and her father can access from their phones, letting them know when the pillbox is being opened, when the car is started, and when the coffee is made. Signals of an aging parent's normal routine can give comfort that sometimes all is not wrong. The next step for Aging 2.0 is potentially to set up a nationwide network of older consumers willing to share their insights. And while this may not make money in itself, according to NPR, Ms. Fike believes that it could be the next big thing to improve the lives of older adults. Back in 2010 and 2011, I wrote a paper for what was then called the European American Business Council, or EABC, on the benefits of foreign direct investment. Many of us who have worked in the IT and communications sector have often promoted the economic growth and other benefits of drawing investment from non-native companies and sources, although the data on these benefits and their impacts is often hard to come by. In steps the Brookings Institution into this breach in late June with a report by Devashree Saha, Keenan Fikri, and Nick Marchio called FDI in U.S. Metro Areas, the Geography of Jobs in Foreign-Owned Establishments. The report represents new data on jobs in foreign-owned establishments in the 100 largest metropolitan areas in the U.S. Fully 74% of all jobs in foreign-owned U.S. affiliate companies are concentrated in these 100 metro areas, according to the authors, and that's compared to 68% of total private employment concentrated in these same areas. The number and share of U.S. workers employed in these foreign-owned companies rose steadily through the 1990s before peaking, according to Brookings, in 2000 and then stagnating. Of the large metro areas, the percent of total private employment owed to foreign direct investment runs from a high of 13% in Bridgeport, Connecticut, to a low of about 1% in Provo, Utah, although there are typically higher shares of jobs in foreign-owned companies in metro areas along the East Coast. When the survey data concludes in 2011, nearly 18.5% of U.S. manufacturing workers were employed in foreign-owned entities, with 1.4 million U.S. workers in the country's technology and skill-intensive advanced industries. On the whole, according to Brookings, the average large metro area contains foreign direct investment from 33 different countries and 77 different city regions worldwide. The Brookings Survey on Foreign Direct Investment in the U.S. can be found at www.brookings.edu, and it details data on each of the covered U.S. metro areas. In October, the International Bar Association will publish a book tentatively entitled Key Issues in Communications, Media, and Telecom Sectors, in conjunction with their annual conference to take place this year in Tokyo, Japan. I'm proud to have an article entitled The Role of Privacy in a Changing World to be included in that publication. What you'll hear next and over the next 2 weeks is an abbreviated sneak peek at this article, which I hope will spur your interest in the publication, the work of the bar in this area, and the many excellent authors taking part. In October 2013, I was interviewed for an article that appeared in the Christian Science Monitor. The topic was the NSA surveillance revelations and their potential impact on U.S.-European Union trade and other key negotiations. A friend of mine had been forwarded a copy of my remarks and emailed me with the following kernel of resignation. Our privacies once enjoyed are a thing of the past. Now, I've heard variations on this theme for many years, even more, of course, within the past year. In May of 2013, Judge Richard Posner of the Second Circuit wrote an editorial for the New York Daily News calling privacy overrated. His core theme, that privacy and security are in constant balance against one another, is very sound, even if his enthusiasm for security to be ever favored in the balance might today be seen as understandable pre-NSA revelations exuberance. An August 12, 2013 article in Time magazine highlighting that privacy is illusory just days after the NSA audit reports on privacy violations were made public was less excusable. It reminded me of the old Monty Python sketch, the British policeman standing in the midst of a melee, holding a bullhorn and calmly imploring, "Please disperse, there is nothing to see here." In late November 2013, at the U.S. Federal Trade Commission's forum on the Internet of Things, a long-awaited discussion on the swirl of issues brought about by the prospect of connecting everyday devices, cars, power, etc. to the Internet, a remark was made that privacy may actually be an anomaly, if not a product of our modern industrial age. The speaker described a time when people lived in small villages and everyone knew everyone else's business. When we began moving into cities, he argued, we developed anonymity as a byproduct of urbanization. What is privacy? And why is the view of privacy's lessening relevance in the information age simply not credible? Let's start by first debunking the notion that privacy is of modern origin. Regardless of whether you are a Christian, it probably would not surprise you to learn that the authors of the book of Genesis in the 1st to 2nd century AD were interpreting already age-old stories and legends passed down from generations earlier. Thus, it's also likely not surprising that when Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3 verses 8 and 9 are suddenly aware of their nakedness and reach for leaves to construct a bit of privacy, the authors make no reference to an app for that. The notion of what is privacy may be nebulous, but its function in society is not. On Tuesday, December 4th, 2013, the White House's Nicole Wong, Deputy Chief Technology Officer, made what was for her a rare set of remarks at a practical privacy meeting of the International Association of Privacy Professionals in Washington. In her remarks, Ms. Wong cited the late privacy scholar Alan Weston's premise that privacy itself is not an end state, but that the end state is freedom of expression, with privacy as a means to that end. This reference to Weston's seminal writings is spot on, but there is much more to what he said. Weston was speaking here to one of three facets to privacy, informational privacy. The second facet for Weston, territorial privacy, refers to the ability to control the information that enters and leaves one's personal sphere. And finally, privacy of the person describes a person's right to be protected against undue interference of a physical nature. For instance, why issues of birth control, abortion, commitment proceedings are all typically framed as privacy issues. Weston wrote that informational privacy is the claim of individuals, groups, and institutions to determine for themselves when, how, and to what extent information about them is communicated to others. Freedom of expression, though critical and particularly in the context of the U.S. Bill of Rights, is only one part of the equation. To use an analogy, Adam and Eve, when they decided to cover their nether regions with leaves, were not likely doing so with the aim to make a statement, but rather to not make one. To say nothing and not have that nothing by itself interpreted as expression is just as vital, but this form of protection requires communal action or standards to blunt whatever interpretive value might be drawn from daily lives. To use the example I mentioned earlier from the FTC's Internet of Things forum, but in a way turn it on its head, when a late Victorian tight-knit Italian or Jewish community in New York City may have decided to look the other way when the local priest or rabbi would regularly imbibe too much on a Friday night, they were creating privacy by social construct. When various cultures and ethnic groups urbanized, privacy was hardly thrown to the wind. It was often even more fervently guarded as a critical maintenance of culture. Similarly, when any set of neighbors lives in close proximity long enough, watch programs develop, block parties can happen, but also the occasional harmless indiscretion of a neighbor's child can be winked at. This is society creating a sense of dignity, the state or quality of being worthy of respect. This is human. Privacy is dignity. For so much of our early U.S. history, the maintenance of privacy as a bulwark of dignity was very much driven by our religious and ethnic socialization. The social standards of what was private were embedded in immigrant traditions from Western and Eastern Europe, Africa, Asia, and then Central and South America. These traditions were carried like a comfortable blanket from home and into growing communities of like-minded and like-empowered homogeneous peoples. Even in the close confines of East Harlem, proximity did not blot out privacy. To the contrary, a sense of dignity required it. As these communities dispersed, the maintenance of dignity through privacy became rooted in far more practical concerns. Even today, as Rosa Brooks wrote so well in Foreign Affairs in late 2013, we're most often concerned with very concrete kinds of economic and physical harm, from social stigma to job loss to theft, injury, imprisonment, or death, and not an often nebulous vision of what is or isn't private. Privacy, in the context of these concerns, supports dignity as a defense against the harms that can flow from power, its uses and abuses. We fear that we'll end up on a no-fly list, or be unable to get a security clearance, a job, or a loan. From a neighbor using our past as leverage, to a thief knowing where we keep our jewelry, to a government seeking to curtail dissent, or worse. What frightens us most is the very concrete possibility that information about us, however it is gleaned, will be misconstrued, misused, or abused. Individuals began to look more often to the law for maintenance of dignity through privacy. Indeed, the greatest growth in U.S. case law on issues of privacy occurred in the periods following late 1800s industrialization and post-World War II, times of great movement, resettlement, and technological development. The Internet and the advance of the information age, while welcomed for all that will do for economic growth, education, and global communications, has also exacerbated the gap between concrete fears regarding data misuse and the maintenance of dignity through privacy that had once been the domain of cultural and religious traditions. Next week, part two. Has law bridged the gap? Assuming that we know what the gap is. You have been listening to 40A&M in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40A-M.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from the BBC, The Guardian, The Washington Post, National Public Radio, and the Brookings Institution. Thank you for listening. 40A&M in 5 will be back with you again on Monday, July 21st. Until then, of course, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.